Okay, so first of all, let me thank the organizers for a nice conference. I'm going to be talking about some recent work with Finn Larson that appeared in this paper. So as you've heard from Atish and Bernard DeWitt, there's recently been impressive progress in computing black hole entropy from the microscopic and macroscopic point of views and understanding deviations from the Bekenstein-Hawking area formula, even when these corrections are large. Now, these agreements are very impressive, but for various reasons I'll describe, they're quite mysterious, at least to me. And so I'd like to try to clarify some of these issues from a slightly different point of view. So in particular, let me view the situation from in the context of ADF-CFT, where we really understand best the relation between black holes and spin theory. So so what do we do in ADF-CFT? Well, we start with some system of brains, and BPS system, we like to count as a bound state degeneracy. Okay, and on a system of brains, there are two types of charges, which we're calling P and Q. The P type charge is the heavy charge of the system, which defines what the conformal field theory is. And the remaining Q charges are then excitations in that conformal field theory. So for example, in the D1D5 P system, the heavy charge is the D1D5, and the light charge P is described as an excitation in that system. Okay, hopefully that works. All right, so in this conformal field theory, we'd like to count up the degeneracy of states. So the simplest thing to do is to compute the conformal field theory partition function. So we give a potential phi to these Q charges and compute the partition function. And if we want to get the degeneracy of states, then we can perform an inverse Laplace transform. Now, what ADF-CFT tells us is that the CFT partition function is equal to an ADS partition function, where these potentials become the boundary values of fields. If we could compute this ADS partition function exactly and perform these integrals, we could get the exact bound state degeneracy. But that's out of reach, the exact answer. But what recent work has shown is that we can understand the perturbative local contributions of this partition function, we can get the degeneracy, the leading exponential part, and all these 1 over charge corrections, as Atish described. Now, Aguri, Strominger, and Vassa conjectured a relation of this to the topological string partition function. Essentially, in this language, they conjectured that the ADS partition function is the square of the topological string partition function. And this seems to work great in the cases that it's been tested, but it's rather mysterious. So in particular, we know that it captures the F term from R squared type corrections in Lagrangian, but it doesn't include higher curvature terms like R to the fourth. And a priori, those would seem to, these higher terms would seem to spoil the agreement. And if you just check one of them, for example, it does change the agreement. So what I want to argue in this talk is that, in fact, this local part of the partition function, which is responsible for an agreement, is basically determined by symmetries and anomalies. I think our gravitational anomalies will play a crucial role. And from this point of view, we can understand the non-renormalization of the entropy due to these higher curvature terms. And also, once we viewed it in this way, we can extend some of the previous calculations to include non-BPS excitations and situations where we fix the angular momentum. Okay, so a quick overview of the remainder of this talk. So the attractor mechanism plays a crucial role in what we do. So I'll start with some general comments on attractors. Then I'll turn to entropy in general higher derivative theories, independent of string theory or supersymmetry, and show efficient ways of computing that and give a nice, essentially, derivation of Wald formula from a non-standard point of view. Then we can turn to the use of gravitational anomalies and then some examples, depending on time. Okay, so the attractor. Well, a typical black hole or black ring solution in string theory typically has sort of a three-layered structure. So first of all, there's the asymptotically flat region at infinity. Then if we take the Moldacena decoupling limit, we'll get an asymptotically ADS solution, and that outer ADS region I'm going to call the UV ADS. Now, in simple cases like the D1D5 system or D3 brains, you get exactly ADS. But more generally, as you flow in radially, the geometry will deviate. But if you have the situation of a black hole, the attractor mechanism will eventually take over, and you'll find a new ADS in the IR region. If you want to understand black hole entropy, it's really the IR ADS that's of interest. That's where the horizon is. That's what's governing the entropy. However, you might want to take that entropy and express it in terms of the charges of the UV. CFT, in which case you have to understand relations between the two sets of charges. And these can be important in various contexts, but they can be understood by studying the explicit supergravity solution or in conformal field theory. A nice example of this are the black ring solutions in the type 2B frames, as Henry and Elving explained. So this system has two types of charges. There are conserved charges of the D1D5P variety, and then there are non-conserved dipole charges. In the UV, the conserved charges dominate. They're what you see at from large distance. And so the UV CFT in this case is the standard 4,4 CFT of the D1D5 system. Then you start flowing in radially, eventually the dipole charges dominate, and the dipole charges are the D1D5KK type, and those define a 4,0 CFT. So that gives rise to this RG flow between the UV and IR. What's interesting here is the actual attractor mechanism is functioning in terms of dipole charges, not in terms of conserved charges, and that's an unusual situation. But Finn Larson and I studied this in the general context, and we could sort of map out when it is the conserved charges or dipole charges govern the attractor. And in either case, one can write down an attractor function contracting the moduli of the charges, or the dipole charges of the moduli, and extremizing that attractor function gives you the attractor. This can also be thought of as extremizing the central charge, as I'll mention. Okay, so now let me turn to the main topic, which is black hole entropy and higher derivatives. So most of the work on the subject has been in the context of near-horizon ADS2 geometry. And particularly ADS2 cross S2 is the most common situation, and that's because that's where one has great control on the supergravity side. One knows a lot about the higher derivative corrections, which is the R-squared type. However, in string theory, you really understood black holes best in ADS3. We have the conformal symmetry, and that's a big help. And so I'm going to look at cases where we have a near-horizon ADS3 geometry. And now this doesn't mean I have to look at a different class of examples, because in the cases of ADS2 that have been looked at, you can uplift that to ADS3. So we can study the same class of examples in the context of ADS3. The canonical example will be M-theory on Calabi-Yau threefold, where we have some wrapped M5 brains on 4 cycles and M2 brains wrapped on 2 cycles. And this is related by dualities to various systems that have a simple microscopic description, like the heterotic string on T5 or the D1D5 on T4. Or K3. But for now, let me just forget about string theory or supersymmetry and just consider a general diffeomorphism in variant action and see how far I can go with the entropy in that context. Okay, so right off the bat, I'm going to reduce the theory on X and get down to a P plus three-dimensional action, which I've written here. So this general action, which I'm taking to be diffeomorphism invariant, that's important, has three contributions. There's some bulk action, some boundary terms, and if I have gauge fields in my theory, I might have Chern-Simons terms. I'm going to isolate those for reasons that will become clear as we go along. Now, the key assumption, as I said, is that we assume that we have ADS3 times SP written here. Furthermore, I'm assuming that the symmetries are realized here in the sense that all diffeomorphism gauge invariant quantities are constant on the solution, field strengths are covariantly constant, and so on. Now, so given this ansatz, appearing from this action, what would you like to know? Well, you'd like to know a formula for the radii of the ADS in the sphere. Furthermore, Brown and Snow have taught us that any theory of gravity in ADS3, even asymptotic ADS3, defines a conformal field theory. You'd like to know the central charge. Brown and Snow gave us a formula for the central charge for a two-derivative action, but we need to generalize that to the general higher derivative action. Now, it turns out to be surprisingly easy to accomplish this. So let's ask, how does one determine the radii? Well, when the equations of motion are satisfied, the action should be stationary under a local variation of the radii. So let's look at a local variation of the radii. Well, there'll be one term, it's just this ordinary derivative of the bulk Lagrangian. Then for the derivative terms, after integrating by parts, you'll get various covariant derivative terms. But everything's covariantly constant over the background, so those all vanish. And therefore, finding the radii just means extremizing this function. Now, that function in the background, square root g times L, is basically L ADS cubed, L to the P, times the bulk Lagrangian. And if I also go and attach this factor, then as we'll see in a second, the function that I extremize turns out to be the central charge, the generalized Brown-Hanow central charge. So how do you see that? How do we see this prefactor? Well, it comes from the conformal anomaly. So let's write ADS3 in coordinates such as the boundaries of two sphere. What's the value of the action? The bulk action, that's easy, everything's constant over the solution. So we evaluate the action is divergent, of course, from this large eta integral, so we have to put a cutoff, And then we can study how the action changes at the cutoff. And that's what I've written here, the linear and the cutoff. So what does this mean? Well, let's think of this, in these coordinates, we can think of this as defining a conformal field theory in S2. That theory is a conformal anomaly proportional to the central charge, and that conformal anomaly also tells us how the action should scale under change of the cutoff, under vial rescaling to the boundary. And it changes like C over 3, delta A to max. So I compare this formula to that formula, and I read off the central charge, and that's what I've written here. So the upshot of this is that determining the radii on a central charge just means solving algebraic equations, minimizing this, extremizing this function. Okay, so now we have the central charge, what do we do with it? Well, it turns out to be quite easy at this point to get formulas for black hole entropy. So in particular, given this ADS solution that I assumed, I can take an order fold and get the DTZ solution. Now, to get the entropy of the DTZ solution, you can evaluate the action of Euclidean DTZ and then use thermodynamic type formulas to get the entropy. So here's Euclidean DTZ, it's a solid torus. The direction around the horizon is non-contractible due to the horizon, so that's the angular direction phi. The imaginary time direction, the circle, that's contractible. Now, suppose you relabel phi and t. Then you get this picture over here, and now this non-contractible t circle defines a finite temperature theory, and in fact, this finite temperature theory is just thermal ADS, like global ADS with compact imaginary time. Another way of saying this is these two geometries are related by modular transformation. You take the parameter of the boundary torus, they're simply related like this. And what this tells you is that you can relate the DTZ partition function to the thermal partition function, and that's convenient, as you'll see. So let's think of the partition function, let's think of these geometries as contributions to the total ADS partition function. And I've written that here in sort of a CFT-inspired language. So what's the contribution of thermal ADS? Well, thermal ADS is just global ADS with compact imaginary time. Global ADS is the NS vacuum. It has L0 equal to 0, on left and right. So even the minus I here is the action, so you compare those formulas with this relation, that tells you this is the action for thermal ADS. And I've even assumed independent left and right moving central charges. The point is, everything is determined in terms of central charge because of these formulas. Okay, then you do a modular transformation, you get the action of DTZ. Okay, let me make a couple of comments about this. First of all, this is basically a trick for computing action. I could have just taken Lagrangian, evaluated it on the DTZ black hole, and gotten it that way. Second of all, this is not meant to be an exact computation of the contribution of the partition function. This incorporates all local higher derivative terms in the Lagrangian, but it doesn't incorporate non-local effects because things might wind around the circles, like brain instantons and whatnot. However, as I said, if you know the local part, you get the local part right, you'll get all these power law corrections of the entropy. You won't get the exponentially suppressed terms, but that's not what we're after here. Okay, so given this partition function, you want to do this inverse Laplace transform to get the entropy, and I've written this in terms of beta and u, which relate to the tau parameter like this. The simplest thing to do is to take the saddle point approximation, and after a little bit of work, you find that the entropy is given by Cardy's formula. In terms of the central charges and the weights h left and h right, which are in turn related to the mass and angular momentum of the black hole. Now this is sort of a familiar formula in this context, but what I want to emphasize here is we derive it for an arbitrary diffeomorphism invariant Lagrangian of higher derivatives. And this says, it looks like ADS-CFT, but this is at this point nothing to do with ADS-CFT. It's just I'm just evaluating the black hole entropy from the gravitational point of view. Okay, a couple comments. Instead of doing the saddle point approximation, you could have done the full integral, then you'll get a modified Bessel function as Atif described, and this will give you all the power law corrections, but I won't say more about that. Now what we found here is the entropy for a BTZ black hole in arbitrary diffeomorphism invariant theory. All the higher derivative corrections absorbed into the values of the central charges. And as written, of course, that result has nothing operating to do with the area over 4 of the black hole. And as Atif also described, Wald has given a general formula for black hole entropy and higher derivative theory, derivative of Lagrangian expected curvature, integrated with the horizon. And so, of course, one should ask how that Cardy formula I derived relates to this Wald formula. Well, in fact, they're precisely equal. So the Cardy formula is written in terms of the central charge, and I said that I determined the central charge by the C extremization procedure. So if you use that fact and some dimensional analysis, you can rewrite C in this way. So if this was Einstein-Hilbert gravity, This factor here would be 3. This would be the standard Brown-Hinault result, but this is the generalized Brown-Hinault formula. And now you can, if you substitute this in the Bacardi formula and do a little work, it's not, you know, a few lines, and you find that this Wald formula is precisely equal to the Bacardi formula, a fact that was actually known earlier due to the work of these people. Okay, so let me do a quick example. So just first with 2 derivatives. So the basic example here is M-theory on Calabi-Yau's threefold. Let's look at the 2 derivative Lagrangian. So there's some metric, scalars, vectors, Chern-Simons terms. You wrap M5 brains on 4 cycles, you get ADS3 cross S2 cross CY3. Carry out that C-externization procedure to solve algebraic equations, you get the central charge, similar formula to what appeared in Andy's talk, and this is the correct known result. Okay, so this theory, this 2 derivative order, has an ADS3 defined to 4, 0 superconformal theory, both in the bulk and on the boundary. Now I'd like to ask, how can I compute higher derivative corrections for this result? So for the C-externization procedure, you need to know the central charge, you need to know the full Lagrangian to compute the central charge. And here in ADS3 cross S2, I don't know all the higher derivative corrections. So either you have to wait for the supergravity people to compute all those corrections or find a better method. And in fact, there is a better method. So again, at this 2 derivative order, we have ADS3 cross S2 cross X with 4, 0 superconformal symmetry. Now I don't know all the higher derivative terms, but let me assume that once I add them in, they preserve the symmetry. I can't prove that, but if it turns out not to be the case, then it's a breakdown of ADS-CFT. Now we come to an important observation of Harvey, Minozian, and Moore from 98. In the context of M5 ring gravitational anomaly cancellation, they pointed out that symmetries in this system relate the central charges to gravitational anomalies. And that's very good because gravitational anomalies are not going to get random corrections. They're under excellent control. So how does this work? Well, over here we have 4 supercharges. That means there's an SU2R symmetry. There's an anomaly that tells you that the level of that current algebra, and supersymmetry relates that to the central charge. If the left and right central charges differ, then there's a gravitational anomaly in the theory. And so knowing these 2 things, you can read off both sentences, see left and see right. Now, crucially, these corrections of central charges in this anomaly cancellation comes from an inflow mechanism. And that inflow in 5 dimensions is coming from a single R-squared term with no further corrections, no corrections from R^4 terms and higher. Just a single R-squared term. So if you can understand that term, the claim is you're understanding the central charges. So the conclusion is that, and I'll go into more detail, is that the R-squared terms which have been studied are preserving the symmetry and correctly accounting for the anomalies, and therefore they give the exact result. Individual R^4 terms, you start adding random R^4 terms, those are going to change the central charges. No question about that. But the full set of them preserving the symmetry must give 0. Otherwise, they would lead to corrections of the gravitational anomaly, and that would be an inconsistency of M5 rings. So let's see this in a bit more detail. So the key term, this R-squared terms in 5 dimensions, is actually descending from the C3, which X8 term, in 11 dimensions. This term appears in 11-dimensional action and appears with a known coefficient due to, well, one way of looking at it is from M5 brain anomaly cancellation. We want to reduce this thing down to 5 dimensions on the Calabi-Yau in the presence of some M5 brain wrapping 4 cycles. Okay, so if you reduce that term, one of the terms you get in 5 dimensions is of this form. Okay, so here I have the linear combination gauge fields that couples to the M5 brain, first Plancher-Yagen class. Now, this way of writing it isn't really well-defined because we have magnetic charges. A isn't well-defined, so you should integrate by parts. Integrate by parts, you get F wedge omega 3, Lorentz Chern-Simons term. And now we look at this term in ADS3. Well, this term is not diffeomorphism invariant, okay, due to the Chern-Simons term. In the M5 brain anomaly story, you get contributions from a source at the M5 brain. In ADS3, we're going to get boundary contributions at the boundary of ADS3. So this is, you know, locally diffeomorphism invariant, but not up to boundary terms. Okay, a little bit more detail about that. So we take that term in the action, do a diffeomorphism, and if that diffeomorphism just acts tangent to the ADS3 boundary, then you get this sort of boundary term. Compare that to the gravitational anomaly in this CFT. That's proportional to the difference between the central charges, equates these formulas, that tells you C left minus C right. Then you go and look at diffeomorphisms on the sphere. That's like an SU2R symmetry anomaly. And that'll tell you a correction to C left. C left is where the SU2R symmetry is. Putting these two together, you get corrections, add those to our lowest order results, and you get the exact central charges originally computed by Malvasine, Strong, and Witten, and reproduced in essentially this way by Harvey, Minazian, and Moore. And again, this formula is exact because it's related to anomalies, which can't be corrected. Okay, so applications. This is an example that Atish talked about, where you relate to the heterotic string spectrum. And so we take M theory on K3 cross 2 cross S1, that's related to the heterotic string on T6. Take an M5 brain, wrap it W times on K3 cross S1, that's dual to a heterotic string, wrap W times on S1. This is a case of a small black hole. The leading contribution to the central charge vanishes, so we have to look at the corrections. Then we use the fact that C2 of K3 is 24. That tells you the left moving central charge is 12 times the wrapping number, C right is 24 times the wrapping number. And this looks good because 12 and 24 are the central charges of the transverse matter on the heterotic string. 8 bosons and fermions on one side, that's 12. 24 bosons on the other side, that's 24. So we're getting the central charges of the supersymmetric side of the heterotic string and the non-supersymmetric side. So if we do use Carty's formula and take that saddle point approximation to give Carty's formula, plug into the previous results, then we get this entropy formula for the small black holes that Atish talked about, correct for the heterotic string. And one could also reproduce the power law corrections by doing a few other steps, which I won't go into. Okay, now what's intriguing about this is Carty's formula applies for both left and right moving excitations. So nothing stops us from using this formula, and this applies even for non-supersymmetric cases. So it has something to say about the non-supersymmetric states of the heterotic string. At first that sounds extremely surprising, but then you remember that in ABS-CSC we are able to account for entropy of non-extremal black holes, and this is really just another example of that. Okay, the other example is heterotic spectrum of BPS heterotic strings, and we also add in fixed momentum, winding number, and angular momentum. And here we draw on some related work by Izuka and Shigemori that motivated our analysis here. So the microscopic entropy formula is given here, at least for sufficiently large angular momentum. And so to sort of understand this, first thing to think about the case where you choose the maximal angular momentum, where you have zero entropy, J equals NW. This describes a heterotic string, which is a helix. It's a unique state, no entropy. Now reduce the angular momentum a bit. Now the string can wiggle around, and those wiggles give entropy, and, well, they give this entropy. And the claim is that we should find a black object which reproduces that entropy formula. Now, first, this looks sort of difficult, but what happens is that the attractor mechanism sort of focuses in on the local geometry here, and the attractor is just the same one in the case of a flat heterotic string. So we dualize this to M theory with a helical M5 brain, apply the Carty formula, and now here's a step which isn't at this point rigorous, but quite suggestive. So this is a case where we have to relate the UV and IR charges. So in particular, the total momentum measured in the UV is a contribution from the weight here appearing in Carty's formula, plus a contribution with overall gyrational motion of the string. So one has to add them together. This happens in very similar examples, so I think this is pretty safe. And in those examples, one then relates the angular momentum to this gyrational momentum. Lambda is the wavelength of the excitation. Take the longest wavelength, that gives the most entropy. You get a relation between H right and angular momentum. Plug that back in, and that gives you the correct entropy formula. One could also dualize this to type 2B frame. Then you'll get a formula for the D1D5 system on K3, where you fix the R charge. And that actually is the known correct result. Okay, let me conclude. So what I hope to have convinced you here is that symmetries and anomalies are very powerful in determining black hole entropy, including corrections. A lot of information is packaged in terms of symmetries. Now, there are various puzzles. For example, we need a better understanding of non-perturbative effects. So I said we looked at the local contributions to the actions in higher-order terms. We didn't consider brain instant contact effects or summing over geometries, and those would be needed to understand the exponentially small corrections of the entropy. Now, a puzzle in this subject has been that the case that you might have thought would be simplest, just the type 2 string case instead of the heterotic string, or alternatively M5 range or the B1B5 on a torus rather than some complicated Kolab Yau, this case seems actually much harder to understand. And I don't know the answer. Well, nobody's been able to identify a black hole whose entropy reproduces a microscopic degeneracy. So I don't really know the answer to this question, but let me just make a couple observations and maybe helpful. First of all, in these cases, the gravitational anomalies that I relied on very heavily vanish in this case. So one gets no information from that point of view. Now, I think it's been hoped that R to the fourth and higher corrections will sort of explain the story somehow. But if that's to work, I think it has to work in some rather unusual way for the following reason. So Kutusov-Larsen-Lee, based on the formalism of Kutusov and Seiberg, considered the exact world sheet analysis of heterotic and type 2 strings with the addition of NS5 brains and Kluze-Klein monopoles. One can compute the space-time central charges in this formalism, and this is going to incorporate all the alpha prime corrections. In the case of a heterotic string, you get a contribution from these, C0 is the contribution of these 5 brains and KK monopoles, but you get a residual 12 and 24, which would survive even if you turn off those contributions, turn those contributions off. And the type, and that's of course what you want, 12 and 24. In the type 2 side, there are no such corrections. The leading semi-classical result is exact. So the R to the fourth terms don't seem to be correcting the central charges. What I think this means is that the type 2 case is somehow not just a naive extrapolation in the same way that the heterotic case is. And of course, it would be very interesting to understand exactly what's going on, but I don't have anything to say about that at this point. Okay, thank you.
Questions?